Pop Spotting 113.
Wednesday, August 24th, 2011.
Welcome to Pop Spotting. I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
It's Wild Card Wednesday, and I wanted to go back to books because I've recently started a new series. I'm doing that right now, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. But for right now, I think I am going to hit you with my all-time favorite books ever, but for right now, subject to change.
Okay, so you're another top five, I would imagine.
Yes.
Well, that's good. I mean, we've done a few book shows. We've covered what you have been reading at that point, but I think it's great to cover things that you like for all time, at least for right now, because maybe if folks get a sense for what you like, they can make recommendations. We've gotten a lot of great recommendations from our listeners. They're on your to-do list, so let's do that as well. So number five, all-time favorite book for now on your list.
Number five is East of Eden by John Steinbeck. I'm not particularly well-versed in John Steinbeck. I've read maybe three of his novels, but this one is my favorite for a lot of reasons. I think it's the story of Cain and Abel, but told in a very Steinbeckian setting. It's set between the Civil War and the Great Depression in Northern California. It's about two families that kind of grow together in the area. And the two brothers, the Cain and Abel figures, they're abandoned by their mother. And the whole Cain and Abel betrayal is played out via mommy. The two brothers come to a very heated disagreement, and the end result has to do with their mother. It's a story about friendship. It's a story about family. It's a story about struggle. And the most memorable part of this book for me is a character by the name of Lee. Lee is a cook and kind of a valet character, and he is from China, and he is struggling to balance his Chinese identity with his desire to become American. He speaks pidgin around almost everybody to hide the fact that he's reading and that he's learning, and he's the most wise character in the novel, and he really brings a kind of philosophy to the novel. He brings his own philosophy, and he kind of shapes the lives of all of these people around him. The Hamilton family in the novel is based on Steinbeck's own family. He considered this to be his best novel, and Steinbeck makes a cameo in the book.
Now, this was published in 1952. East of Eden, of course, a reference to the story in Genesis. Is it really a biblical, allegory, or is that just the setup? I mean, does it really play out the way that a serious scholar of the Bible would be able to predict, for example?
No. It's more like just an inspiration. It's like Steinbeck was reading the Bible and thought that Cain and Abel were interesting, and thought it would be kind of fun to put a frame work around Cain and Abel.
And this Lee character, this person who came in from China, I mean, I'm surprised that, I mean, is he a prominent character or just the one that really spoke to you? Because here's a novel, Steinbeck, it's about the American voice, the American experience, but you're really intrigued by someone who perhaps sees it as an outsider or somebody who wants to be a part of it but has an outsider's perspective.
We don't see him much, but he does give a lot of advice that really drives the narrative of the story.
All right. Well, that's a solid and very serious sounding pick. What have you got for number four?
Catch 22 by Joseph Heller.
Ah, yes. A book that, for one, is mentioned in Lost, for example.
It's a huge influence on Lost in a lot of ways. It's non-linear, for one thing. The narrative does not go in any kind of a line. There are multiple points of view, tons of characters. It's very confusing and very labyrinthian. And there are similar themes about how all of these people get along with each other in a very confined and kind of a scary situation.
Now, Catch-22 is, of course, a classic, but you picked it up at around the same time that you were kind of working your way through that Lost reading list. There were some other titles as well.
I read Catch-22 the same time I read Slaughterhouse-5, which we also see on Lost very briefly, and it's been connected to the story of Lost in a lot of ways. And Catch-22 and Slaughterhouse-5 have a lot in common, very similar themes. They both take place during a war. They're both about the way people cope with stress and the horrors of war. But I really liked Catch-22 much, much more because it's the story of a whole bunch of people. There are multiple narrators, most of them very unreliable. They all have stories, and we are forced to piece together what is really going on from the narration and from certain events that happen in the novel. I like this book because, well, like we were talking about The Big Lebowski the other day,
right on Monday,
and how we like the language in Lebowski because there's circular and repetitive language, and it really adds to the dramatic effect of the book. And the same thing is true of Catch-22. There's a lot of doublespeak, also like in 1984, which is another lost book. Mm-hmm. And another reason why I love this book is because it's darkly funny. There are parts that are laugh out loud funny, and there are parts that are horrible, and they all work together, and there's just a lot of sarcasm and absurdity and kind of making fun of bureaucracy in action and in life, and I really enjoy that in a novel.
Well, you know, this sort of institutional dysfunction explored here, when you were describing some of the Catch-22 scenarios, it reminded me of Dr. Strangelove, the movie, about just how ridiculous it is. You know, Catch-22 is a reference to a random and obscure law that kind of is, you can't win either way with it, and
right.
That kind of ridiculousness is how you have the Doomsday Machine in Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. So similar, would you say, tone or kind of a perspective on the way that governments and people work?
I think you can't like one without liking the other. I think if you're a fan of Dr. Strangelove, you'll like this book and vice versa.
All right, Catch-22, published in 1961. So what's book number three?
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Hey, wait a minute. Don't go anywhere. Okay. Yes, I know it's melodramatic and it's overblown and your teacher made you read it and
exactly.
You kind of hated it. But I got to admit that I was forced to read this book my senior year, but something about it just hit me. I don't know what it is. Maybe it was the angsty teen in me, but I really connected to Heathcliff, and I really connected to Catherine and their forbidden love and all of the horrible things that their families did to both of them. And Heathcliff really is the ultimate anti-hero. He's dark, he's moody, he's violent. He's really not a very pleasant person, but you find yourself rooting for him because he is really in love with Catherine, and they have such a tragic relationship. And because of the times in which this book was written, there's so much that can't be expressed. It's not written in the book or in the dialogue anywhere, but you can feel it. You can feel the jealousy and the passion and the forbidden love and all the rage. You have to sort of read between the lines to get there.
Well, you know, that makes me worry because I'm pretty sure this book was assigned to me in school, and I'm pretty sure I pretended to read it, but now there's stuff that wasn't written down that I probably missed. I mean, what are some of those unspoken, unwritten things that draw you to Wuthering Heights?
In the middle of the book, Heathcliff goes away for a little while. He disappears. Nobody really knows where he goes or why. There's a book called H, which was written in 1992, which attempts to explain what might have happened to Heathcliff. Mm. And it's apparently not very good, but it's something I think everybody is curious about, especially considering the fact that Catherine has a baby and the dates are slightly off, but I really believe that Heathcliff could be Kathy's dad. And that's a question that could never be considered in the pages of a book published in that era.
For sure. I mean, this was the only book written by Emily Bronte. She had a couple of sisters that also were published, but most of them had to write under a man's name before it was actually picked up.
Right. Both of her sisters, Charlotte and Anne, wrote under pseudonyms.
So here we have a book, definitely a great exploration of its time, also of great passion. I have to ask you, though, I mean, I'm not sure any guy really reacts to this book the same way you did as a hormonal and melodramatic teenage girl.
No, that's true. That's and that's fine. But guys would not really respond to this, and I'm not sure that women that read this book as a teen would respond to it either at this point, but I still do.
All right, all right. Well, I personally want to kind of leave those flashbacks to AP English in the rearview mirror, so let's move on to your next book.
Number two is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. Yeah. I was reminded of this book when we went to see Captain America. Remember how Captain America grew up in New York and he talks about all the places where he got beat up?
Right.
And it reminded me of this book because this book takes place in New York City right around World War II, Joseph Cavalier comes to America from Eastern Europe to escape the Nazism, and he ends up living with his cousin, Sammy, and together they start writing comic books, and they become famous. And this book is about not only their interpersonal relationship, but their professional relationship. And all of the events in the book are interwoven with actual historical events. The book ends on the Senate hearings in the 50s that concerned juvenile delinquency, and they mentioned this book, The Seduction of the Innocent, in the novel, and I thought that was just a plot device. I thought it was something that they made up for the purpose of the plot, but it turns out that this was an actual book, and they held Senate hearings about it, and that really fascinated me.
So you have these comic book authors, you know, coming to America, finding some success, but then getting embroiled in controversy about comic books as a medium. And I mean, well, right now we have sort of the same issues. Well, television was going to corrupt all of the minds of our youth, and now video games are going to corrupt the minds of our youth. So in many ways, it's like, I guess history is repeating itself. I mean, do you pick those parallels up in the story they tell in this book?
Yeah, of course I do, because this is really just the story of America. In America, things happen all the time in cycles, and it's interesting to pick up on that. But another facet of the story that affected me is the fact that Sam Clay, one of the two main characters, is gay, and the story is about his struggle with his sexuality in an era when it was really the ultimate taboo.
Well, I've heard a little bit about this book. It was, I think it's the only book on your list that's won a Pulitzer Prize, for example, and it certainly seems like a great exploration of the early days of what we call now American pop culture. You know, you've got comic books and dealing with censorship. You mentioned Captain America. Could this be a movie someday?
It could. Actually, no. The scope of this book is so big, it can't really be contained in a 2.5-hour event. I think it would probably make a really bitchin' miniseries, though.
Ah, okay. Maybe we'll wait for that. I know that there's been talk for a long time that there'd be a movie, but that still hasn't quite materialized. Well, at long last, what is your favorite book of all time for right now?
A Prayer for Owen Meany.
Ah, okay.
By John Irving. I don't cry at the ends of books. I'm more of a movie person. I really need something visual to get the waterworks going, but this book made me sob. I read it just as Lost was starting its last season, and I became convinced that this book would make an appearance on the show because Owen Meany is a very Desmond-like character. He glimpses his fate, and he takes steps to make sure that this fate actually happens, and it's really the story of Owen attempting to make right the things that he thinks are supposed to happen, but also his lifelong friendship with Johnny Wheelwright, who he grows up with in New Hampshire in the 1950s. It's really the story of faith and destiny and loss. It moves through the Vietnam era, and it kind of switches back and forth between the story of Johnny and Owen and where Johnny is at that particular moment, which is it's the 1980s and he's in Canada and he's teaching at a private girls' school.
So you've got flashbacks, you've got someone who sees his destiny and goes around trying to make it real. It's essentially flashes before your eyes in literary form?
Yeah, I believe so, but more about friendship and family, because after the death of Johnny's mother, Johnny is virtually adopted by Owen's family, so in a way Johnny and Owen almost grow up as close as brothers, and it's the story is about the love and friendship and the letting go that friends do when they reach a certain age.
Well, you said it made you cry. You've got it's called A Prayer for Owen Meany. It's not, I guess it's not a spoiler that something doesn't, that things don't end well perhaps for Owen Meany?
No, they don't. And he reveals what happens to Owen within around the first 5 pages of the book.
And so even though you see the end coming, you're still bawling.
Absolutely. I knew what was going to happen. I didn't know how it was going to happen. And the way Irving gradually reveals what's about to happen to Owen makes it very surprising and very shocking.
Wow. Well, I will probably have to check that one out if it is, in fact, your favorite book of all time, at least as of this point in time, A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. That came out in 1989, so you've got a pretty good range here for your top five.
Yeah.
As current as the year 2000, that's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, going, of course, all the way back to Emily Bronte in 1847. Well, that's Jen's top five books, and really, this show can pretty much be seen as an excuse to hear what your favorite book of all time is, so we can further extend the reading list for Jen here. But before we go, we did want to do what we normally do with our book shows and basically ask what you're reading right now.
I am reading The Talisman by Stephen King and Peter Straub, which is turning out to be a more arduous task than I originally thought it would be, because I read the sequel to this book first. I read Black House a while back, and Black House was the story of a man who's now an adult, but in childhood he went through this fantastical adventure, and The Talisman is the story of that. And I am a huge Stephen King fan. I've read 75% of his works, and believe me, there were a lot of them. And well, Peter Straub, I'm not really all that familiar with, but what I'm sensing from this book is Stephen King is providing the character stuff in this book, and Peter Straub is really providing the fantasy, because there's really a lot of fantastical elements to this story, and it's very dense. There are pages that I've read over and over and over again because they're just full of detail, and I really want to see all of this detail in my head, so it's taking me a while.
Well, King brings the character, Straub brings the fantasy, and it sounds like the fantasy is the challenge. I mean, I don't think Stephen King does a lot of collaborations.
No, these two books are his only collaboration.
So the question is, do you think you might have enjoyed this story with a little less Straub in it, or do you think the combination is perfect, but it's just taking some getting used to?
No, I like the combination. This is a fantasy novel that really works for me. I'm enjoying it a lot, but it's thick and it's dense, and there are a lot of characters.
Well, it sounds a little bit like our discussion of Game of Thrones.
It does take place partially in a medieval alternate universe.
Okay, well, in terms of fantasy, though, that's you're kind of going on a two-barreled theme here, because you are also reading Harry Potter.
I am reading the Harry Potter series.
You're
for
the last
the first
person on Earth.
Time. I am the last person on Earth, but I'm fine with that. I read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in about 6 days. I read Chamber of Secrets on the plane back from Comic-Con, and I'm halfway through The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay, well, you know, our daughter is a huge Harry Potter fan, and, you know, she's now one of those buzzing around the extension to Harry Potter universe called Pottermore.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a huge property. Why now did you decide you wanted to get into it? I mean, or basically, why did you hold off, perhaps?
I held off because there was just no escape the hype. I was hoping that at some point I wouldn't hear about Harry Potter anymore, but that just hasn't turned out to be true. But we took our daughter to see Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Yeah, midnight showing.
I was so inspired by that movie. It was such a great movie, but I didn't know what the heck was going on part of the time, and I really wanted to find out, so I decided to dive in.
All right, so now you are in J.K. Rowling's world. I will confess I have not read all the books either. In fact, I only read the first one, The Sorcerer's Stone, because it was assigned in my last year of my 9-year bachelor's degree program at UH, and unfortunately it was one of those children literature, you know, courses where everything isn't as simple as it seems. A magic wand is not just a magic wand. Everything is about repressed sexual urges and the evil patriarchal society, etc., etc. So it was very difficult to enjoy it at the surface or even at any level of depth, because we were overanalyzing, at least I felt. And so I have to ask you, you know, that was J.K. Rowling's first book. She set out to write a children's novel, but of course it was insanely successful and popular, and she wrote several books, and I would hope, you know, her style had evolved and grown over that time. Just from where you are, is that what you're sensing? How did you like the first book versus where you are?
I think her stories are becoming more sophisticated. Sorcerer's Stone is actually a pretty short book, and it tells a very simple story. And now that I'm up to Prisoner of Azkaban, there are a lot more characters, and there are a little bit more layers to all of these characters. And it's interesting to think that people grew up reading these books, and their sophistication levels changed. And I can imagine how exciting it must have been for a kid to start off on The Sorcerer's Stone and go all the way through.
Well, I can only speak from my understanding of the movies, which of course our daughter watches over and over again, and even that I enjoy. Just even as the actors grow and the stories get darker, it becomes a much more adult story, and that's what I really like about it as well. Our daughter is one of those children who's grown up on this story, but from your perspective as an adult, going back to this very well-celebrated and adored universe, even though you've come to it late, even though you were skeptical at first, do you love it? Are you going to finish the whole series? I mean, would you recommend it to someone who might have been in the same boat and had resisted all of this Potter mania?
Yeah, go ahead and read them. I think they're great books. They're very entertaining. And yeah, I'm totally going to finish them.
All right. Well, that might just be stubbornness more than anything else, but I'll take it. I'll take it. So recommended, that's what Jen is reading right now. We've shared her top 5 books of all time, but now we want to hear from you.
We're always looking for interesting topics to tackle for our Wildcard Wednesday show. So give it to us. No matter how crazy you think it is, we want to hear about it because some of our best ideas have come from you. So if you have any or just random thoughts or suggestions or whatever, please get in touch.
You can leave a comment on our blog at popspotting.net. You can send us an email at feedback@popspotting.net, or you can leave a voicemail at 815-310-0808.
If you want to start a conversation with other Pop Spotting listeners, feel free to post your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/popspotting.
You can also find us on Twitter at twitter.com/popspotting.
Tomorrow on Pop Talk and Trivia, we'll be joined by a podcasting survivor.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to say thank you to Dan Pashman of The Sporkful for our theme song, but we really want to say mahalo to you for listening.
For Pop Spotting, I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
Aloha.